This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. Today, I'm joined by Jakob Lutgau, researcher at the Frems Institute for Research in Computer Science and Automation at INRIA. I met Jakob through a collaboration my lab has with the University of Tennessee, at which point I think you were a postdoctoral researcher and then the research assistant professor, I think. So Jakob has a wide range of interests from HPC to performance optimization to storage systems to machine learning and converged computing. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we usually kick things off by giving you an opportunity to talk about your background. So let's do that. I am interested to hear about your training and how you got interested in all of these niche areas of computing.
Well, I studied informatics at the University of Hamburg and basically stayed throughout my master's and PhD in Hamburg because there was a data center close by, the German Climate Computing Center. And sometime in my bachelor time, I got in touch with HPC for the first time. Basically, never had a reason to go away for longer and study abroad or something like that. I did a few internships though, so like there was always opportunity to stick around with HPC. But originally, I wasn't sure that I wanted to study informatics, actually. I was more drawn towards bioinformatics, but there wasn't a bachelor entry level course for that. So basically, I stayed with informatics and since then, usually went with a more general thing, because over time, I think I realized that it's pretty easy to always come back. And then I get excited for many things, so I never really had any regrets in that sense. So, yeah.
And before you were studying that, like when you were smaller, what kind of oriented you to these kinds of computational things in the first place?
So I guess I was always interested in computers. I don't know, at some point you have the first computer at home, and I think one of the first things I did was break it. Well, I guess I think I only changed the font, but it rendered it unusable for my parents for some time until they got it fixed. And I think it was actually my brother that got a book about HTML or something like that, where I really got in touch with the first kind of programming. So I don't know, there's something magical to just opening a text file and then you have the browser and it just does stuff and shows something. And there's this like very short reward loop towards doing something. Then actually I didn't really have programming courses or something like that in school until a little later. So we did have like a robotics school with Lego Mindstorms, where there was some C programming, but at the time I was too young, I was a little bit over my head. And then many years later, I think I got started with PHP actually, and did websites and databases and messed around with some data sets. I remember there was a CIA World Factbook and I really liked the data set. So I was trying to put that into a relational structure and it didn't really work out because the data that they have didn't lend itself to. And in other cases, there was like these online games. So I like to do little tools like maps to kind of see what was the most useful position to build your next settlement or things like that. Or I know a lot of these games, they did have an end game. So you would kind of need to collaborate with different people. So you needed some logistics backup because you had to bring resources into something that you wanted to defend. I think that's kind of the ramp for me into computational things.
So I noticed in your training, you've traveled back and forth and back and forth from Europe to the United States, and you are still in one piece. But in all seriousness, what has the cultural transition been like? And do you have favorite places to live and any tips for someone that's in your shoes?
I mean, it's true. There's some overhead to moving back and forth. There's like paperwork and regulations you have to do. I was relatively confident with English. We just have English relatively early in school. I was kind of writing a lot in forums to do that. And in that sense, like I wasn't really so afraid of moving abroad. And it was mostly curiosity. I really liked to see new things and also new lifestyles. My parents always traveled a lot, so there was maybe some tendency to do that as well and be able to combine this with work to an extent. But it is also draining, of course. So like, I don't know, I remember every time when you do something, it gets it in intense at times. Yeah, the back and forth. So like I spent two internships at Argonne National Lab for like 3 months at a time. And then like lived for 2 years in the United States for when I was at the University of Tennessee. So because my brother was doing exchanges with the US anyway, and we traveled a couple of times before, there was not much of a cultural shock, I would say. So like some of the things I already knew. So the transition in that sense may have been not so bad, but there's still like a lot of unexpected things, of course, and like staying for a couple of weeks on vacation versus moving life temporarily is of course a different thing. I think like these different experiences in the past definitely took a little bit the edge away from some of that.
Gotcha. So you are fairly interested in storage, which is something that is kind of new to me. I guess not totally new with respect to HPC, but definitely with respect to how challenging it is in the cloud. For our listeners, let's do a storage 101. Tell us how storage works on HPC, maybe how it works in the cloud, and the challenges for each.
Okay, so I mean, everybody has a hard drive in the system at some point, and so like I think that's a building block that everybody knows. And supercomputers and clouds, they are not different in that they take these smaller devices and then they aggregate the performance by taking 1,000 or 10,000 of these to provide a storage systems that fits the need of the applications. So like I worked a lot with climate data, for example, and these are just by the nature very large. If you take the world and you kind of put a grid around it and you chop it up into a few billion cells, then you just end up with a lot of data. So you need to coordinate a lot of these different smaller building blocks. And then the way that storage systems build, they typically build a hierarchy of things. So on the lowest level, you have these devices, but because the devices are limited in capacity and in speed that you can access, you start to spread out your data set or your data across a lot of devices so that you can access in parallel. And then that allows you to get high aggregate performance over the data. That's kind of the key with all storage things. And the architectures for cloud and HPC are actually very similar. It's large distributed storage systems for the most part. And then there's some interesting things coming up now where a lot of the decisions, how you build these systems, they depend on the economics. So you need to take a commodity and then you try to build a powerful system from that. And this is getting more flexible because the industry and the users and the technologies are maturing to a point that there's more flexibility, but it means that more and more research is moving towards algorithms and how to drive these systems that give you more flexibility. Because this hierarchical approach that you have in storage systems, for the most part, it allows you to make many simplifying assumptions. So the management is a little easier, and that is kind of breaking away slowly.
So you said these decisions depend on the economics. Can you expand on that a little bit, what you mean by economics and what variables are involved?
I think coming from HPC, we usually, so there's a small time in history where you would build processes and hardware, especially for HPC. And then at some point, that wasn't feasible anymore. There was no vertical scaling. You couldn't get faster because you ran into different physical limits, or the temperature couldn't be driven away, or you were not at a technology where we could control the errors that were introduced at the scales that we were working. So at some point, these cluster architectures took over because they were just much cheaper, and the problems lent themselves to that anyway. Because you use these smaller building blocks. So like when they built the first cluster computers and also cluster storage systems, they basically used stock hardware. And then over time, this became more specialized again because there was enough of a market to actually produce these things. And I think when I talk about the economics, there's this problem that if you want to build a hard drive, it's a fairly complicated mechanical thing. If you want to take an SSD, there's just a lot of, like, it takes a lot of time to get to this technology to work. So you need to amortize this with enough units that are being sold. And so there's always this relationship where you are pulling back and forth between this kind of the dream requirements that you would have, or like the ideal requirements, and then how can you put this together from pieces that are cheap enough that you have. And then by working around these constraints where things are diverging from your ideal architecture, that's where a lot of the complexity comes in, I think.
So when I think of HPC file systems, I think of NFS, I think of Lustre. Can you tell us about some of these bread and butter HPC oriented file systems and what they're each good for?
Yeah, so I think NFS is increasingly driving out of HPC systems. Like today, you wouldn't really deploy that anymore. There's this part where file systems evolve very slowly. We're still dealing with POSIX semantics, so it's kind of a standard that was invented 20, 25 years ago, where basically you had a certain idea of how our computer systems looked, and you made a few guarantees about, like, for example, there's some metadata guarantees. Every time you touch a file, you would kind of update the timestamp, which is a useful function for a lot of users. But once you are moving to a distributed system, that becomes a liability. You have to propagate this information. And if you have to propagate it to a lot of different systems, you incur additional latency as before you can kind of have the system in a state that everybody agrees, okay, that's the timestamp. And in the meantime, if you are working in an HPC context and there's been updates applied already, so like the information is out of date, and then if you were to kind of try to get everybody into a coherent state, you would basically never be able to catch up with the technologies that we have. So what you do is you abandon this guarantee and build a system that has fewer things. So NSF did a little bit of that, but then NFS still. So NFS is really just an interface for that, like what architecture is behind that. You can hide different systems behind it, but the key is that basically the storage system is hidden behind the network and it's not on the actual computer. Your hard drive is not in your computer anymore. Your storage is somewhere else. NFS is kind of one of the earliest technologies for that. And then as the systems grew and needed more performance, you needed better approaches that were offering better performance, in particular metadata and bulk data performance. And Lustre, for example, they break this off into two different tiers. They have metadata servers and they have data targets. And basically, you configure the compute nodes that are providing these metadata services and data storage services in a way that you can configure the optimal performance. So metadata targets, for example, in many cases, they would deploy SSDs and then the bulk data was using HDDs. Today, there's some systems that would increasingly do SSDs also in the bulk data, depending on the performance requirements that you have. But it basically depends on how much money you have available to spend. And that usually becomes a trade-off because you kind of know that your applications require a certain capacity and then you need to meet at least that. So that's like all the home directories that your users are wanting to store, or like all the data that your users want to store that should kind of fit on the Lustre file system. And then at some point that is not enough even because you kind of add additional tiers. So like most of the bulk data that is supposed to be kept for a long time, it's not living on these Lustre file system, it's living in tape archives today.
When you have an average HPC user that is requesting resources for a job, how informed or not informed do you think he or she is about the storage needs?
So it depends. There's really users that are very informed, and then there's users that don't really have an idea. I think the tendency is that you don't get a lot of exposure to the details of the system, and that makes it very hard to be informed about the system. What you see is you're writing to a directory, and maybe you have some commands in Lustre. You can kind of do some fine-tuning, but that's about the level of interface that the storage system gives you. The idea of the storage systems was to hide a lot of the complexity. And that also leads to the situation that users are often not very informed about the systems because without privileged access, you don't even get so many details.
So patterns of I/O input and output are really important for choosing a storage strategy. And arguably, this is a lot of sort of what's hidden from the user. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so like, I think the key is that you are wiring a lot of disks together and kind of connecting them to a lot of clients. And there's contention, just like you would have in a network of streets, that basically, depending on the pattern, you have situations where a lot of load lands on a particular storage target or on a particular path on the network. And that is kind of why the I/O patterns are so important to optimize I/O, to make sure that you avoid contention where you can, or that you load balance if you know that some routes are already busy, or that you make copies of the data so that you're not always hitting the same target for something that's requested very often.
Going back to our Storage 101, what are high level, like the different patterns of I/O that we tend to see?
I think the key breakdown that is typically done is that in many storage systems are optimized for sequential I/O, and it's kind of the most naive strategy that you can also implement, because if you know that like you start reading a book and then you know like, okay, you will need the next pages relatively soon, and like the last pages of the book very late. Something like that is true for a lot of applications, and they tend to optimize to read like that. But then there's also workloads that can't really do that, because you have random processes, and machine learning in particular, for example, needs to seek randomly into data for best training performance. You can kind of hide some of these effects from the storage system perspective, but it requires pre-processing and planning. So I think random I/O and sequential I/O are kind of the two extremes where you can't really do much to, or like where the penalty was the biggest because of the way that the devices worked. It's a little bit better today because we do have SSDs that have very high random I/O performance. But when you were working with a disk-based system, you would kind of need to spin and drive the reading head of your hard drive to certain locations that just like resulted in a certain sequence in which you would kind of do operations. So like if you were able to reform your data access pattern into a sequential sequence, you would benefit the most because you just wouldn't need to move your head much.
So just to state it really simply, patterns of I/O can be broken down into different patterns of reading and writing data.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, awesome. So a question that I'm curious about, have you explored or tried any approaches using eBPF, the Extended Berkeley Packet Filter, to assess I/O patterns?
Yeah, so there's so extended Berkeley filters, maybe to an extent, they kind of evolved as something that was primarily used in firewalls. Basically, you can have a little payload and use it to collect custom performance counter and react to certain trigger points. And like the Linux kernel and many other devices nowadays, they allow you to basically in eBPF program the information that you want to collect. That's kind of one of these dilemmas that you have with instrumentation, that you have to hook this in a very low level. So in many cases, you needed to recompile your application. And with eBPF, your operating system gives you more hooks to tap into and basically on the fly decide what information you want to collect. And one of like you can also hook into a lot of the system calls that are used for I/O dispatch. So basically, that's what you would do with eBPF, that you kind of say, I want to hook into the open calls and then count how many open calls are there, or maybe you want to build a table of file pointers that you access. So one problem with eBPF, where I didn't work so much in the HPC context with that, is that you require relatively privileged access to systems. And until recently, you just wouldn't have that. The HPC systems are also kind of updating on a slow rate. So they had older kernel versions. They wouldn't even come with kernel support for eBPF. It's a relatively new thing that you can even do this in modern machines.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, we have a compiler on a system. I think we have GCC like 4.9.3, which is like ancient, and I don't even want to know honestly what how old the kernel is because it's probably like from when the dinosaurs roamed the earth. But yeah, I'm interested in that particular thing to test. I would test it in places where I would have, all the permissions and a new kernel and whatnot. But I think it's a really cool space of things to explore. So we
Yeah,
haven't
definitely.
talked a lot about storage in the cloud. Can you tell us, akin to how there's different storage systems for HPC, what are the common strategies that people use to store data in the cloud, and what are the challenges around using them?
So I think the biggest thing that the cloud did was basically introduce a new interface, and it makes some sense that like the cloud storage was often addressing something as store content for the web. So you would have different files and objects that you would want to address, and you had an identifier for that. So maybe you didn't even need the file system to the same extent because you in your website you have a URL that you put. You have a very reliable identifier, and you can resort to different strategies to finding these things. Now, of course, a lot of static content in the web is still organized in directories. But the key is that there's this S3, which kind of became the de facto standard for interfaces in cloud storage. But architecturally speaking, they are actually very similar under the hood. So, like if you look at Ceph or Swift in the OpenStack context, then you are using an object storage backend where you're still spreading data across a lot of devices like hard drives or SSDs. And by determining what kind of access quality of service you want to these, you would spread this across more targets, or you would have more replicas for the data that can be served. So in that sense, that's why I was earlier saying the general strategy to achieve high performance and high availability is actually very similar, no matter if you are in an HPC context or in a cloud context.
One thing I've noticed actually in both places is that file systems, whether they happen to be on a cluster or in object storage, they tend to be like wastelands of disorganized files or blobs that people forget about or poorly manage. Can you talk a little bit about this problem with organization and what the future could look like? Or are we going to just remain in a hairball of files for like all of eternity?
But I think the key here is actually the integration with workflow systems. So in the past, I don't feel so comfortable to speak for the web in general, but like for many scientific contexts, at least by mixing the workflow perspective and the data that you store, basically keeping provenance information, you can automatically label a lot of data and assign categories and keep around information about the data that you have. And that gives you a lot of pointers and important metadata that you would typically use to search for data that allows you to find that. Now, a lot of data that was generated in the last decades, they didn't have the tools to do the same. And they also, it's really impossible to know in advance all the things that you want to do in the future. So I think there's always going to be some case where in hindsight, we will say like, oh, we could have done better if we would have done something differently. But I think it's also as part of the evolution of science that like you can't anticipate everything. But one thing that I think will facilitate things a lot, because you can't go into the file, or like you can, but it's very expensive. If you have to do a full text search, or like you're looking for a certain, maybe paddling back a little bit. So in science, one of the first steps to tackle this was the introduction of self-describing data formats. So you're not dealing with an opaque data format. You have a good idea of what's in the data, and there's metadata in the set already. But if you move that over to the archive and you never made a note that you have this file, then you have a tough time finding that. So what is being done today is that there's a lot of cataloging efforts that basically go back to these old data sets. They look at the descriptions that are associated with the files, and then they just put that into an index where they say like, oh, we have the inventory that says this is data that we have in the first place. And then on top of that, you can build search tools to explore that. And all the different domain communities, they are building fantastic tools that fit what the application and domain actually needs. And I think that's another thing where there's kind of this tendency to wanting to build something super central, But then you have to make it simpler and you lose searching power. So you want this approach maybe where you find the right communities and then they have more specialized tools. For example, if you're dealing with geographic data, maybe you want to be able to explore this on a map. And in the last 5, 10 years, I think that's something we saw, like large science organizations like NASA or NOAA, and the same in Europe with ESA, they are making their data available and they provide the tools to search for that. But then there's like secondary layers where you have large data portals that just aggregate over that and say, hey, there's a data set there, and then you would view it in a different context again. And I think that's a good path forward in general. If you never build inventory and never like registered with the index, then at some point it probably falls down and you lose that data.
I think I've seen that too, definitely in biology and definitely in neuroinformatics, where different kind of online repositories and databases emerged based on actually, for example, like a standard format. And it's not that the approaches are super complex. It's like what you said, there's a kind of file format that has a particular piece of metadata. The tool learns how to parse and then store the metadata, and then you search the metadata. But you're totally right that you couldn't just, you know, pop in a different data format and expect that to work. But I think the overall approach has feet for different communities, and a lot of it is just kind of the extent to which communities can share data. So imagine if you have like, you know, top secret security research data, you're not gonna, you know, very easily put that in an online repository for others to take advantage from, which leads me to my next question. And maybe the answer to this question is obvious, but to what extent do you think the need to actually share the data leads to the development of these kinds of interfaces?
I mean, I think if you didn't share data, you wouldn't need to build the interfaces. But I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? Like you are doing research and you want to, I don't know, like to an extent you have to build a career on top of the data that you create. And there's like some incentives to be very protective about your data. And then on a societal level, I think we see that if you share this, you facilitate a lot of research. Or like it makes things much faster if you can rely on a data set that is somewhere else and you don't have to compile it from scratch. So collaboration, they actually yield something that's much bigger of the individual parts there. And I think we do see this, that we have increasingly interdisciplinary projects as well. And I think it's these collaborations that actually facilitate the need for exchange. And I think it showed in a range of different like areas. I think the high energy physics community, for example, was among the first that were taking advantage of the internet to move data around at really large scales and develop infrastructure to do that. And with that, they also became the first to define some standards. And then other communities, they to an extent adopt things that they see there. Then they have different needs and then they evolve something next to that. There's, I think, an exchange between these things. Now, I think there's always this Cambrian explosion of different communities developing their own solutions, but eventually it has to collapse again, because as you have more of these interdisciplinary teams, the overhead of dealing with the heterogeneity that you have there, you have to reduce by developing standards.
I've seen a similar cultural academic thing come into people's incentives for sharing data. So back when I was at Stanford, I worked for a lab that did research and it had a bunch of radiologists and like a sprinkling of grad students. And then I was more of sort of like a staff that was part-time there. And they had this beautiful data set. I think it was bone radiographs. And they were trying desperately to, you know, have the grad students do work that would publish. They wanted to be the first, you know, they had this data set, it was theirs and private, and they wanted to publish from it. And I kept noticing that like they weren't getting kind of like the shiny result that they wanted, that they deemed good enough for publication. And I kind of very nicely suggested, you know, you can publish the data set. You can publish the data set, you can get it out there. You can get many more eyes on it, many more people working with it to actually find something really interesting, and you will be cited for that. It's still kind of a win-win. And they were very, I remember being in this meeting and they're very averse to the idea at first. But years after I left, I looked back and I think that's exactly what they did. And not only that, they kind of oriented their lab to doing more of that. So I think it's interesting with data because, you know, the fear of getting scooped or having a data set and wanting to kind of squeeze, if we imagine this like something like a juice that you can squeeze out of, like wanting to squeeze out all the publications that you can out of it before you share it. I think that actually gets in, it's one of those academic incentives that actually gets in the way with what should be the ultimate goal of science, which is to discover new knowledge and maybe to do it collaboratively. Just an interesting point to add.
Yeah, I agree. I think one also sees this with software, and I think that's kind of the way that funding agencies operate and what kind of KPIs they look at. So, like the key performance indicators. Basically, for some time, the currency was publications, maybe primarily journal publications, and like some communities lean to be heavy on conference papers, and then like you see a slow adaptation in the field there, then like they increasingly saw that like data citations were important, and communities and organizations around that formed like DataCite, and that you can have DOEs in the first place. I think there's this evolution, and now I think we do see the same for code, where code was an engineering task that you had to do, but it wasn't a scientific contribution that would kind of guarantee you the next round of funding when you were applying. And that's changing as well, but I think the system is always lacking a little bit behind because some of the innovation, yeah, comes back. Or you have to publish something in multiple formats, like you publish a data set, but then you still have to get a publication on the data set somewhere.
So we've been talking about storage a lot. Let's do a little change in topic. Tell us about your new lab. What are you excited about?
Yeah, I think what is most interesting for me and why I kind of felt consequential to also make this as a next step is I think that we see this evolution towards this convergence of computing paradigms. Initially, HPC, cloud, and embedded systems and edge devices, they were kind of different fields and they were not really connected. And I think what one sees is that it's kind of fusing into a computing continuum where you have HPC and cloud and some parts and the edge. And that's something that many domain sciences are doing. I think one sees this in the high energy physics communities that had to do data reduction at the edge, so where the sensor is. And we do see this, of course, in Earth observation, where you can capture so much data that you want to filter some of the relevant data. And this is kind of true for a lot of disciplines, especially as sensor platforms got so cheap. But there's still like some central processing that you want to do. And then I think the line between HPC and cloud is kind of blurry anyway, because I think in the mindset of some, HPC was always kind of something that is now branded as cloud. So there's kind of, I think, some of these aspects. And because the data generation and processing chain is kind of spanning across these different technologies anyway, I think there's a drive to find a programming paradigm that allows you to describe one and use it in all these contexts. That is something that is emphasized a lot in the institute where I'm working now. And that's where I feel like it's a good environment to do research, the topics that I care about. And one of the core topics there is, of course, how do you handle data storage and how do you do analysis on top of this data? And so that's kind of where I can bring together a lot of the topics on workflows and on machine learning and I/O patterns and like the computer architecture side together and kind of see like how can we do this more efficiently, more performant, more energy efficient, things like that.
You've just described what I would call converged computing, and it's also what I'm immensely passionate about. Just this gray area. I think in a talk I called it the fog of war. Like there was like cloud land and HPC land, and in between is the fog of war. I think that's it's such a cool space to explore, and there's so many different aspects. We haven't talked a lot about machine learning, and that's one of your expertises. How does machine learning come into, for example, studying converged computing?
So I think it comes back to the complexity of the systems and basically needing to identify the bottlenecks, but because we are dealing with so many moving parts, it just becomes unwieldy to find. And because you're moving to platforms where every time you deploy it, the hardware that you have underneath is taking a different shape. So you need to react to that. And I think that is one of the strongholds of machine learning, that you are dealing with adaptive environments. It becomes very complicated to write software with a lot of conditions that would kind of cover all the cases, where machine learning actually offers an opportunity to, by giving examples or at looking at performance data and then turning it into an optimization problem, to incrementally find an optimal solution based on observations. And I think that's kind of why these topics are a good marriage.
So we are coming up on time. I'll ask just a few more questions. So I'm not sure I have this right. INRIA is in France?
That's right.
Okay, can you tell me, I am not well traveled at all. Can you tell me a little bit about France? I have this idea in my head that it's very like romantic and like little, yeah, just tell me about it. I'd love to hear about it.
So I'm in the lab of INRIA. It has multiple labs. And so they are in 8 or 9 different locations. And they typically have labs that are co-located with universities and a few different universities. So it's actually interesting to see for me, because in Germany and in the US, it feels like there's more hierarchy in many situations. And like with the US National Labs infrastructure, for example, there's a lot of diversity within the lab, but there's still only a handful of labs. Do a little bit of everything. And INRIA is kind of special because it's very focused in its mission, I think, because you have a research organization with a fair amount of employees that are exclusively focusing on the digital technologies. And that is an interesting model that I didn't really see so much somewhere else, but I think it's quite convincing. And then for France in general, so we are based in Brittany, and it's having these rocky cliffs, and the weather is a little bit volatile, I would say, like not in the sense it changes very quickly. So you might have 10 minutes of rain and 10 minutes of sun and 10 minutes of rain sometimes. But overall, it's colder than Tennessee, but it's warmer than Hamburg, where I'm originally from. So actually, I find the climate rather mild, and I don't really mind the swings of weather so much. It's the coast is about like an hour away, a little less. So like there's always an opportunity to go to the beach, which is kind of nice so far. But I've been here also very short only. Like I didn't even see the full rotation of seasons. I think that's something one has to have first before one can say a lot about how life is in France.
Gotcha. I will have to touch bases in about a year after you've had the full seasonal swing. So when you're not working, what do you like to do in your free time?
From a sports perspective, I used to play frisbee and go hiking and things like that. So hiking was something that was really working well in Tennessee. When I was in Hamburg, I was living pretty close to the core park in the city. So I over time had a bunch of friends that we would meet and play frisbee. And it was actually very nice because you can kind of exhaust yourself as much as you want, but if you don't really feel like, you don't have to. It's a contactless sport. And there's also like, if you want to get crazy in technique, you can also more shift towards these things. So you get a little bit of everything depending on what you are after. I do like to do a lot of craftsmanship and things like that, electronic hobbies. So in Knoxville, for example, I joined a makerspace, Knox Makers, and they really had a fantastic and community there and like a lot of different spaces. That's something where actually here I have more makerspaces available than in that area, but that makes it all a little bit harder to get started. So I didn't really settle on which one I'm going to go. And because I was still busy with moving, I didn't visit all of them yet. But I think doing some woodworking or metalworking is something that I like also because I see some similarities even to computing, because like building benchmarks or building software and custom visualizations. It's something that I always do. So there's some tool crafting, I think, involved with software engineering as well. But it's kind of a different kind of things. And I think because you have something that you can hold on to, there's a different reward to doing things. So it's kind of nice. You just put on some music or a podcast and you work on something. Something I wouldn't be able to do by programming. You need to load all the context and the different things into your head, and then you just get distracted. And then like a lot of different electronic projects, or like I built a drone at some point, and then in Germany I couldn't really fly it because the regulations are kind of tough, and in the US I got to fly it even though I had it in Germany before. So things like that, and a fair bit of home automation things is something that I can get excited for. And then, yeah, kind of this mix, being able to rotate between different things that one is doing. I think that's important because one is in a state of mind and then one has to be able to go to different things. Sometimes I like to just go to like a gym and maybe to a spa afterwards, have some sauna and read a book. This is also very relaxing, for example. I think it's like a tiny vacation that you can inject almost every day if you wanted to. And if your gym membership kind of comes with the facilities.
Yeah, I like that perspective. One, it's a perspective of balance, but also kind of to find, as you coined them, tiny vacations in your everyday life. I think people have this perspective that to kind of relax or get work time away from work, they need to take a trip and to travel and to go somewhere very different. And I think the reality is that you can kind of look around you and, you know, at least within the scope of area that you could get to via bike, foot, driving, whatever. And there's actually many, many interesting experiences that you could have that would feel relaxing or different or exciting, that would offer similar benefits without, you know, the airports and the extreme expense of traveling and whatnot. So Jakob, yeah, it has been really fun chatting. We talked a lot about storage. We delved a tiny little bit into other things, but it was mostly storage. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you briefly want to mention?
No, I don't really. I think we made a good round trip. I mean, there's a lot of topics that one could kind of dive into, but I think this covered most of it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I know the time difference is very different and you're probably up super late, so I appreciate that. And I hope we get to do more collaboration in the future.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much.